The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host, guest, random reptoid, or chupacabra may not necessarily reflect those of AM 950 Radio, its affiliates, or its sponsors. Now, it's time to step into the unknown. There are things people experience but never talk about. A shadow moving in the corner, flickering of the lights, a disembodied voice. We invite you to talk with us. Share your story, share your experience. Because this isn't just your story, this is our story. This is Ghostbox Radio with Greg Bakken.
And this is Ghostbox Radio on AM 950, where every night we talk about the paranormal, ufology, Bigfoot, and so much more. My name is Greg Bakken. Thank you for joining me tonight on this Wednesday night as we're about to talk about reptilians, which is something that I've been wanting to talk about for quite some time. Speaking of reptilians, over at the station tonight, we have Adam. Adam, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. My skin's a little dry, so yeah, I guess I am a little reptilian today.
Well, you know, it's just kind of the weather out and whatnot as well. But, you know, I mean, this is a conversation that I've kind of wanted to start leaning into for a while. And I was very lucky to find our guest tonight in the sense that he's once again, like my guest last night, they're right next door to me, basically. And I'm very, I need to kind of look like around me closer, I think, in the future when I start bringing in folks on the show, because I'm kind of missing that local angle here that I really need to kind of step up my game on a little bit.
And tonight's topic is, I know you've been wanting to talk about it. I'm kind of new to the topic. I mean, I've heard of it before, but I've never really taken a deep dive into reptilians myself.
No. And, you know, here's the thing, too. And I think this is why I'm so interested. Tonight we have Scotty Roberts on. If you look him up on Amazon to buy a book, you can look up as Scott Allen Roberts, the author of many books. But what we're going to be talking about tonight primarily, unless we decide to talk about any of his other work as well, is The Secret History of the Reptilians, The Pervasive Presence of Serpent in Human History, Religion, and Alien Mythos. And this is something that I am, like I said, I'm very interested in. There's a lot that I don't know of. Matter of fact, I would say, Scotty, that I actually really don't know anything about it at all, apart from the fact of, like, how cool would it be if there's reptilians walking amongst us? And that's not really what this book is about, though, is it?
It started off being that way. Writing about, my publisher said, I wrote the book The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, and he said he came back to me, and that was my first book with them, New Page Books. Mm-hmm. He came back and said, what are you going to do for a follow-up? And I was just happy to be on board. And so I gave him some topics, and the one that he settled on was, can you do something on the reptilians? And I said, yeah, I can do something on that. I know a little bit about it. So I researched it up a bit, and the book really started out as an expose on the reptilians in culture, in history, as the subtitle of the book says, you know, in religion, alien mythos, historical record. And I started looking at that. And the more I dug into it, I started getting into about midway through the book, you'll find that there's kind of a click over, because I go through a lot of the history, building the mythology part of why we have these stories. And then I went into talking about Freud and Adler and psychology and why they say we have a need to believe the things that we believe. And so it became a book that really started exploring why we believe the stories and what they mean to us, more than it was laying out facts of, you know, the blood types or the rhesus monkey or whatever, you know, and all of that stuff. So
absolutely. And, you know, I think one of the things I find very interesting is, you know, I like how you broke up the book into different parts. And it makes it so you can kind of be able to see where you kind of, and as far as I'm concerned, see where I want to go when I want to read about stuff and maybe go back and read other things. What kind of, I mean, you're talking in here about a lot of very interesting pieces of history here and mythologies that maybe some of us may not be familiar with. Is it? Do you think we need to read up on other things before we'd read a book such as this one?
You know, I don't think so. I make reference to a lot of things, but I also had an extensive bibliography in the book where if I mention something, you can look it up. It's usually annotated and there's footnotes and say, go look this up. If you want to find out more about this, here's my source material. But I try to be very simplistic is not the word because I'm not trying to address simpletons. That's not the point.
Right.
The point is to speak it in as simple language as possible, express what I know, my source material, and try to talk our way through it. You know, why does this exist? Why is the mythos even there? Where does it come from? Where is it going? Why do we believe it? Et cetera, et cetera.
And I do want to let people know, if you have any comments or questions for Scotty, you can put them into the comments. You can also call in 952-946-6205. That's 952-946-6205. The Dead End Collective, who I know you know, says the book is not a direct DNA explanation of where and how the reptilian archetype fits in. So
that's true.
So then what is it then that we are reading here?
Well, you're going to find out first a little bit about where the stories began, the mythos. And I'm trying to decide where I want to start this because I can talk about the history of it, why it exists. You can start going back into the Anunnaki, the Anu culture. You can start talking about Enki, Ea, who is known as Enki, Ea, Enki, also known as Ea. And you can find out why it came from him, how it extended from him, how it extended it into the biblical story of Genesis. Is a parallel to it, or some would say a plagiarization of the old story of Enki and Atrahasis, one of the gods or kings, the Anunnaki, and so on. That story parallels the Edenic story in Genesis. So you can start there by looking at the history there. I think I started somewhere in the beginning of the book. I talked about how I had gotten a letter or a phone call from a woman who said, I think it was an email, because I don't recall actually talking with her, but she was telling me the story of her reptilian story, because I had put it out, and I wrote this book back in 2012, and so I had put it out to my social media at the time. Hey, if anybody's got a good story or an account about the reptilians, contact me. Let me know. Here's my email. And I started getting stuff coming in, and this one woman's story was intriguing. And she told a story, as I'm reading it, of she used to have a reptilian alien that would come and visit her. And she started out sounding very articulate. And the more I read her account, the more I thought, oh, boy, what's this lady smoking?
Yeah.
Because she talked about this reptilian figure that would come. It was once a week or something, every Tuesday night or Thursday night, and it would come through a portal in her bedroom closet. And then she talked about how he would talk with her, and then she started talking about the scent of his skin. He was like cardboard, you know, the smell of fresh cardboard. You snap it and you can smell that, but mixed with cinnamon a bit and spice and all of this, and how that his the texture of his skin, the scales were smooth. It was like silk. It wasn't scaly. And so she started talking, and then she got into, you know, the sex. There was sex. And that's where I didn't really pursue her story too far. But I said, this is a lot of what I started finding out there, were stories like this of people who have this. And this is what I address this later in the book, why people seem to have this need to have something like this happen to them, be it ghosts, be it like the woman in the news in the last few years who married a ghost. People have these. Now, does she really experience the ghost? Did this woman really experience a reptilian? I can't say yes or no for sure. But our innate reaction as humans is to go, what a bunch of B is in B, S is in S. This is a woman who obviously is very needy, has to create this story, and maybe she really believes it. Or, perchance, maybe it happened exactly as she said. And this is the thing with wildly strange or weird stories. We believe the things that we choose to believe. In my own show, I've been going through a series on an examination of the biblical King David, not from a Bible standpoint, but from an historical standpoint. And I subtitled it The Real Life Story of an Invented Hero. And it's sometimes we believe the things we want to believe because they bolster what we need to believe. But then again, maybe sometimes it's exactly what we have believed all along, even though we want to try to pull it apart. So that's where, for me, the beginning of this book came from, was examining, all right, where did this legend start or this mythos start? What was the source point? Why do people believe it?
It's interesting because it's like sometimes you feel like if something is too good to be true, sometimes it can be, though.
Exactly.
And that's, I think that's what throws us off our game a little bit as well. Kind of not delving into the book exactly yet, but Kyle had a question and he's just like, I'm deathly afraid of snakes and really not much else. Why are so many people so disturbed by snakes more than really any other groups in nature? Additionally, those of us that feel that way for no obvious reason, is this our subconscious that knows or remembers something? Basically, he's pointing to like race memory or something like that. What are your thoughts on that? Because I want to kind of have a follow-up to that.
Kyle, I'm right with you there. I asked the question, and I asked that same question somewhere along in the book. I couldn't tell you where exactly in the book it is, because it's been a long time since I've read it myself. But I asked that question, the fear of snakes that we have, that there is an innate fear of them. Is it because we are products of evolution? And in lower forms of primate species, were we, you know, afraid of the predators, snakes being one of them? Is that it? I'm afraid of snakes, but I'm also afraid of lions, you know. If I'm out in the wild, I'm afraid of bears. I think they look cool and cuddly and furry and would look great flattened out in front of my fireplace. But I don't want to encounter one. So we have these fear of things. The reptilian connection to that, I think that there is a distinct possibility that there is something with the reptilian factor that links to something in our subconscious, perhaps a genetic subconscious. But these are the things, when we start talking about this, Kyle, these are the things where we have to start speculating because we have absolutely no idea if that's what's true or not. We can ask the same questions about God or religion. Why are certain religious people afraid of hell? Because they've been taught that there is something there and it's in their subconscious. They can say, somebody might come on here and say, well, that's because hell's a real place and so on. But that's their belief system. So do we have belief systems that are established on something that is fact? Or do we have belief systems that are established on stories that we've chosen to believe? And that's my job as kind of an historian and a writer of weird stuff like this, is to look in the etiology and the etymology of why these stories exist. How did the humans start believing that there were the god of the mountains sent the thunder? Why did they start believing that? What is the etiology? That's an etiology. So why do we believe that there were reptilians and a race of reptilians? And I will say at this point, there is a place where I went online when I first started writing this book. And I even mentioned it in the books. I said, right now, as I'm writing this, I'm going to stop writing this paragraph and I'm going to go Google alien reptilians or reptilian aliens. And then I came back and then the next sentence, I said, okay, now I've Googled that. Here's what I found. And the first top 10 that came up on Google as results were every single one of them was the same exact story of the origins of the reptilians in human history or a definition of reptilian aliens, word for word, some of them barely changed, so they were all plagiarizing each other. The problem was none of them had a source point or source material. None of them stated a source material. You could take some of this back to Zechariah Sitchin talking about reptilians and the Anunnaki. There was no source point. So I found that was almost a useless effort, was looking up, just trying to Google, you know, our Library of Alexandria, our digital Library of Alexandria is the internet. Yep. And you Google something and you come up with the top 10 having the same identical thing in all different websites, not connected to each other. They all copied that from somewhere and probably all believe that that's the way it is. Try that experiment yourself. Type that in.
Absolutely. See what you come up with. Absolutely. I got a question. I have some showing up here in the comments, but I think what I'd like to do first, why don't we take our first break? When we come back, we got some more questions for author Scotty Roberts. We are talking about the secret history of the reptilians and anything you want to talk about in that realm. Or if you have been reading his books and you have questions about anything else he's written about, you're more than welcome to bring that into the conversation as well. You're listening to Ghost Box Radio on AM 950. And welcome back to Ghost Box Radio on AM 950. My name is Greg Bakken. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Tonight we are talking about The Secret History of the Reptilians. This is a book written by Scotty Roberts. You can find his published name is Scott Allen Roberts. If you look on Amazon to get your copy, and please make sure that you do. The book, once again, is called The Secret History of the Reptilians, The Pervasive Presence of the Serpent in Human History, Religion, and Alien Mythos. And Scotty, you know, the question I wanted to kind of piggyback off of what Kyle said, and if you are just tuning in, folks, Kyle had asked the question last segment, basically about, you know, is there something that's embedded within us genetically for those of us who have this fear of snakes and maybe other reptiles in particular, maybe has something to do with history or whatnot. But I also feel like reptiles in general have been a prior in history itself. I mean, I'm looking at Genesis and I'm looking, you know, at the original story of Adam and Eve, which, you know, for so many people, that's, you know, that is, whether it's too mainstream or not, that is like the first step of history for a lot of people. The snake is what makes
it's a reptilian story.
It is a reptilian story. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, yeah. And it's a story that, mimics in most of its details, even though the names are all different, the story of the Anunnaki and their involvement in the lives of humans. In the much older story than Genesis, Genesis would have been, if it was written by Moses, as I believe it was, there's no reason to believe that Moses didn't exist. Mm-hmm. That would have been around the 1400s, early 1400s BCE. The very end of the 15th century, we'll call it. And the Anunnaki story took place 1,500 years before that, where you're talking in Mesopotamia, the Sumerians. They had their god cast, the Anunnaki. And there is a story from the old cuneiform texts called the Tale of Atrahasis, who was the human king of the city of Eridu, which is a city that really, we can pinpoint where it is still today, in the backwaters of the Euphrates River. And he was a human king that his patron god and the god of their city of Eridu was Enki. And Enki was the brother god that Elil, the chief god, conscripted him to create humanity, which Enki did. And then further down the line, and by the way, in the story, here's where you'll start seeing comparison already to Genesis. It says, Enlil, the chief god, says, create man to do our work for us. We need man to dig our canals, mine our resources, till our gardens or our crops, and do our work for us. So Enki makes humankind. And then humankind starts questioning. And the king makes an appeal to his god, Enki. And you read this, and it reads just like a text out of the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And Atrahasis prays to Enki, known as Ea, and he says, "Bend your ear to your servant Atrahasis, and hear our plight, O Lord, and deliver us from bondage to the gods, the Anunnaki." And it says that Enki heard his cry, came down, and he and his followers, they helped the humans fight against the Anunnaki and win their freedom. And for this, Enki is cast by Enlil, into the subterranean caverns of the earth to dwell forever, or the hell of the earth. And Enki actually didn't come down. He came up out of the great Abzu. When he was called up, he lived in the underground sea. And the Abzu was a place where he dwelt, and it was called the Sea of Serpents. Mm-hmm. And or I'm sorry, the Marsh of Serpents, the Serpent's Marsh. I don't know if you've ever heard this before.
No.
But I write about this in the book where, according to the cuneiform texts, Enki, Ea, dwelt in the Abzu, the great underground sea. He would come up in boat with his boatmen through the Serpent's Marsh, which was known as Enki Ea. It was known as Ea's Den. Or if you water that down, you've got Ea-den or Eden. And so you've got Enki in Eden. And Enki, whenever you see symbols of him, he's holding two snakes. And so there's the reptilian connection.
Yeah.
And he comes and he aids the humans in learning the forbidden knowledge of the gods. And by gaining this knowledge, humans have elevated themselves, and they break free of the bondage of the gods. And Enki Ea, of course, is punished for this. Now, in the Eden story, what do you have? You've got 1,500 years later. I think the migration of people from the Euphrates River Valley to what is now known as the Canaanite region. The Romans renamed it Palestine. We know it as the Palestinian region. That's not a country. That was a name it was given by the Romans.
Mm-hmm.
And but in Canaan, they migrated down there, and they took the name, the chief god, Enlil, Elil. They changed it. That became, in the Hebrew tongue, it became El, was the name for God. Where you get Elohim, El Shaddai, El Elyon, the name of God was El. And then you've got also the name Enki, or Ea, which came down. Ea is the base word for Yahweh, which is in the Hebrew tongue, Jehovah. And so what you've got are these two, basically these two gods. You've got El, who is Elohim, and Ea, who is Yahweh or Jehovah. And these are the gods there. And what does it say in the biblical text? Elohim created man out of the dust of the ground, and he placed him in a garden. And the command was to till the garden and keep it for him. What did the Anunnaki have the humans doing? Digging their trench, their canals, tilling their land, and all of this. But they were slaves to the Anunnaki. What happens in the Genesis story? The serpent character comes and, according to the scripture, tempts Eve, seduces Eve. And if you look in the Hebrew language of the text of Genesis, all the action verbs, he tempted her or seduced her. She took the fruit. She ate of the fruit. All these things have sexual connotation to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the story that you're reading in Genesis of Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden, and these are all watered down or slightly changed versions of the old Anunnaki story with different names put to them. What happens in Enki Ea comes down to Atrahasis and delivers the forbidden knowledge of the gods, and it frees them from the bondage to the Anunnaki. What happens in Genesis now? Genesis, the serpent says, if you eat of that tree that God said you can't eat, he says, you're not going to die. You won't surely die. And what does it say? And Eve looked at the fruit, of that tree and saw that it was pleasing to the eye and would taste very good. Well, there was no way for her to know that. But then so she took a bite, and then she gave it to Adam, and Adam took a bite. And instantly it says they were naked. Poof, they're naked all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And somehow misled by this serpent. Now, there are versions, and this is where it falls a little bit. If you are Christian, Judeo-Christian, don't be offended by this. This is just a looking at the passage and trying to figure out if I take myself out of a belief mode and look back into the box, what is this passage telling me? It's telling me that the humans, what happens when they eat? The next verse says, in a more expanded Jewish a portion of the text. And by the way, these texts can be traced back thousands of years. They're not just edits in the 1600s or something.
Right.
So you can go way back to the Codex A, the Codex B. The Septuagint is the Greek version of the Old Testament, which is basically what you have in the Old Testament, the English Bibles today. But you go back there and you look at this, and it says, right after they ate the fruit, they saw they were naked, and Elohim said, the humans have eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and have become just like us, plural. Let us, plural, therefore, prevent them from also eating of the tree of life, lest they become like gods.
Mm-hmm.
And so a couple of things occurred to me as I was writing this book, and questions I had asked a long time before that was, first of all, what did God have against his creation having knowledge?
Yeah.
And that he forbade them from eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And secondly, why has everything got sexual connotation to it? It's all about sexual connotation. What you've got with Adam and Eve and the serpent in the garden, who is, by the way, in the Hebrew, he's called Nakosh. And Nakosh in the book of Genesis simply means the bright, shining one. And you find him later in the Old Testament when Moses, the people are sick, they're being bitten by serpents. Moses creates a brass serpent, raises it on a pole, and whoever looks at that serpent would be healed. This is what God tells him to do. First of all, God sent the serpents to because I'm so pissed off at these people, I'm going to send serpents to bite them. And they'll all die, and they start dying. They plead to Moses, so God says, so now raise a bronze serpent on a pole, and if anybody looks at me. So God creates the thing that makes them die and is making them sick, but then also creates the thing by which they can be healed. And that bronze serpent is called the Nakoshte. It's a variation of the word, the name Nakosh in the Old Testament, which doesn't equate to serpent at all. That connotation was given 1,000 years later, which is interesting. So you see the comparisons between the Anunnaki story and the Genesis story. And so you have to ask the question, which came first and which is the right story? Or are they both just versions of a prototype story? Of an original story somewhere that we don't know what the actual original story is.
Well, and I had wondered.
Very interesting.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just wondering. Yeah. I was wondering that myself because it's like, you know, we know through history things get changed by, you know, word of mouth going down the line or whatnot. But what if that was the case, if you could say that's the case between the Anunnaki story and the Genesis story, we wouldn't necessarily have the Anunnaki story then, would we? I mean, you know what I mean? Where
they
both kind of exist pretty clear.
They exist hand in hand, but one came before the other.
Yeah,
if you went by who came first, seniority, it's the Anunnaki story.
Right, exactly.
The Canaanite peoples changed the Anunnaki story to fit their stories. So were Adam and Eve the real characters? We do know that Elohim comes from the name El. We know that Jehovah comes from the name Enki Ea. And so that they borrowed those names, or were those the same names and they just gave them the other characters different names? It's an etiology. It's an explanation of why things are the way they are. And by the way, I saw Joshua Dixon in your chat room says, I don't believe in organized religion. Well, neither do I. That doesn't mean the object of organized religion is wrong or false or non-existent. I have as much problem with somebody who says the Bible is all myth and therefore shouldn't be listened to or read or anything or believed as I do with people who oversimplify and say it's all true exactly how it's written.
Yeah.
So I think we have to use our common sense. We have to use maybe it's our uncommon sense because it's not what everybody really believes. But you have to look at these things and start thinking about them and then look at history and see how history fits in. Look at anthropology. And I've always said about any text, the only way to understand an ancient text is to put yourself in the place of the author who was writing it in the times he was writing it. Who was his audience at the time he was writing it? Most of these texts weren't written for the ages. They were written for the people around them. And what would those people have understood? And why does that story exist in the first place? And it had nothing to do with what we think we believe.
Well, and I agree. I mean, I think that's kind of the first thing when I do see Joshua say that I don't believe in organized religion. I don't put those stories as part of that because that, to me, in my mind, from what I think what we consider as organized religion today, that's after the fact of these stories of this history too. Yes. So I guess I would agree with you that this is something that, you know, there's a history to it that it shouldn't be just kind of like blindly washed out either.
Right.
Because there's something to be learned from it.
Yes.
So I'm just trying to see here real fast because there was a couple things here in the comments. Let's see here. Getting back a little bit to reptilians in general, Emily had said many of the stories I've come across tend to paint a picture of malevolent race when it comes to the reptilian race. You know, what has your research led you to?
Okay. I can tell you specifically on that first of all, you can find no evidence whatsoever, just like for portions of faith stories in the Bible, you can find no proof that a reptilian race ever existed. Mm-hmm. You can find no proof that there were good guys and bad guy reptilians. One of the stories, and something you're referring to, Crunchy Soap, is that there some of the stories say that there was a terrestrial race of reptilians and an extraterrestrial race of reptilians, and that they came down, they fought with the terrestrial race, they won, and that they are still here, and that they are the ones that are governing affairs behind the scene. You know the old stories. Queen Elizabeth is a zipper human suit that she puts on over her reptilian form.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. Yeah, she's dead now. But what I find really interesting about that is when I wrote about the Nephilim, I went into the Book of Enoch. And Enoch, if you have not read it, it's not part of the canonized scripture that you'll find in a regular Bible. But if you get a Catholic Bible, they put it in the apocryphal books. The apocryphal books were the books that all these bishops back in the 300s to 400s, 500s decided needed to be as the canon of scripture. That's how we ended up with the Bible we have. And there were certain books. The mandate that was given by Constantine at the time was, I don't care what you end up with. He says, it just better damn well be unanimous.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you need to have unanimous decisions. And if there's something they couldn't come up with on particular books that were written, they threw them out if they couldn't be unanimous. But there were some that were so questioned and so close that they set them aside in the apocryphal books, so to speak. And so Enoch is one of those books. And Enoch is vastly quoted in the Old Testament. Some people say, well, Enoch, it was written in the 400s. Well, no, I think it was rewritten in the 400s. It was like the Septuagint. All we have of the Old Testament today is the result of a document called the Septuaginta or the Septuagint. It was the 72 rabbis who, after Israel had been sacked by Babylon, taken captive, hauled away from Israel, and finally the king released them all. You can all go back home now. They go back to Israel, they rebuild the temple, and they send 72 rabbis to the Library of Alexandria. One of Alexander the Great's descendants or generals is Ptolemy II of Egypt. He's the Pharaoh of Egypt, Greek Pharaoh of Egypt. And he gives them permission to come to the library. And their purpose is to reconstruct their ancient texts, which were all burned and destroyed in the sacking of Israel. And now keep in mind, remember, you know, in the Jewish religion, they have this oral tradition. And so they had all the Torah memorized and a lot of but they had to go back into the old books that were at the Library of Alexandria. What an amazing place that must have been. And they spent years there reconstructing, and they reconstructed the Old Testament books. And they did it in the Greek language, which is the language of commerce of the day. And it was called the Septuagint. And that is what that's the document that became the Old Testament you have in the Bible that you have probably sitting on your shelf at home.
Mm.
And that document has all kinds of stories of what happened, what led up to all these events that took place. It's got their versions of these events. And there was probably a specific question in there you asked that in my explanation of the Septuagint, I lost the original question in my head.
That's quite all right, because we're talking about every time reptiles are like that, everything that Emily had come across, reptiles are malevolent.
Yes.
But why don't we do this real fast, Scotty? I want to fit in a break here real fast.
Okay.
And then we'll come back. We'll finish up the show, whatever. We'll answer the question and get to some of the other ones here. We got a big show going. This is a lot of fun. We'll be back more with Scotty Roberts. You're listening to Ghost Box Radio on AM 950. And join me tomorrow on Ghost Box Radio with Greg Bach. And we are going to be replaying an episode that we had in January. We're going to be talking with Mr. Zero. He is all about pop culture and stuff. And when we talk to him, I don't think you could get further from the conversation that we're having tonight. We're talking about not reptiles, but we're talking about monkeys. In fact, the monkeys, as Mr. Zero had spent a considerable amount of time with a couple of the monkeys. And we just kind of took a break from the paranormal that night, and we talked a lot of pop culture. It's very interesting. Mr. Zero's is actually right next door to Mavericks. So definitely give that a shot if you're able to tomorrow night. And then, of course, I'll be doing Myth or Mystery tomorrow here on Ghost Box Radio with Greg Bakken's Facebook page. And we will, as always, take a look at some videos that everyone can vote on, whether they believe is myth, mystery, or unknown. So we are talking with Scotty Roberts tonight. We're talking about his book, The Secret History of the Reptilians, The Pervasive Presence of the Serpent in Human History, Religion, and Alien Mythos. And it's just really interesting because we kind of been talking also just about the imagery of reptiles in history.
Yes.
And what they mean. And I think what's really interesting about that too is, like, I just think about you spent the last 45 minutes having these very deep, strong conversations of history that are so well articulated. So forgive me when I say this.
Oh,
I go back to the sci-fi series V, where they rip off their faces and they're all reptiles.
That's right.
And I know you're just like, you have just taken everything I just said for last hour and just diminished it.
Boils down to V.
It all boils down to V, because everyone seems to have something against reptiles. Like, we look at reptiles. I mean, we look at reptiles as actually very frightening, I think, because I think you and Kyle were really on something earlier in the program.
Well, especially the Gorn from the original Star Trek series.
That too, yes.
Yeah, that was terrifying, that costume. But but even that proves the point that in fiction, reptilians are used to represent the nefarious, the evil, the dastardly, the scary, the frightening. And I don't know what that was. I knocked something over. Sorry for the odd sound.
Paranormal.
But, all through history, we've got all these different types of reptilians that we see. We see it in the Chinese dragon. We see it in Quetzalcoatl of the Mesoamerican cultures, the winged serpent. We see, and by the way, the both being kind of happy creatures. The the Chinese dragon, that reptilian figure is not a frightening character. He's meant to be terrifying to the things that would be against us.
Yes.
He was for fertility and happy crops and happy life and all of this. And so the reptilian, you see the reptilian factor all through history. And then you see it in the mythos that we have, the alien mythos. This is where V comes mm-hmm. in and things like that, is that we have these alien reptilians that supposedly have taken us over, and they're working the world behind the scenes, which is why I kind of lapsed into the, when I was talking about the Book of Enoch.
Yeah.
Enoch, when I wrote about the Nephilim, Enoch, I had people asking me questions about the Nephilim. Well, what about evil spirits and things like that? Is this part of that whole reptilian factor, that evil factor that's behind humanity? And the Book of Enoch talks about how when what we know as the flood of Noah, without getting into the details about all of that and how it fits in, the whole story of the Nephilim and the Watchers, which are equated to the Anunnaki, how the story of these characters is inextricably linked to the prelude of the flood of Noah, and that the flood of Noah was supposed to wipe out this race that had been created in Eden between, because there's a theory, the serpent seed theory, which talks about how Nakosh, the serpent character, is one of the Elohim, and he impregnated Eve, and Adam also impregnated Eve, and she bore twin sons.
Yep.
One was of the blood of Nakosh, the other of the blood of Adam. And if you think that's a medical impossibility, it's not. There have been women, medical record more common than you think, twins that are born of two fathers. And so the interesting thing about this is that the whole Old Testament is the story of this separated seed, that there is the seed of the humans and the seed of Nakosh, and how that, believe it or not, the coming Messiah, the Christ figure, the whole story of the Old Testament is the separation of mankind by that seed and the attempted wiping out of that hybrid race with the flood, how they still existed. It says in the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, it talks about. And if you notice one thing, I don't want to get this too jumbled in my explanation, but you look at like Christmas time, what do we hear all the time? Jesus came, he is the Christ, he is the Messiah, they say. And he is the one who is one of us. And what was the message in the Old Testament? The Messiah must come. He would be what the Jews referred to as the kinsman redeemer, the one who would be one of us redeemer. And they keep saying that over and over and over again, all through the Old Testament, through the genealogies, those boring chapters, all of that. Why? They're obviating the opposite, that something other than somebody who is one of us is out there. And so it's saying the Messiah must come from the line of Adam, not the line of Nakosh.
Right.
And which was the line of Cain.
Yes.
And so you've got the destruction, but then it says the destruction didn't take place. And it says that all those spirits that were killed during the flood will be forever on earth, the evil spirits that haunt and torment mankind on this planet. Now, that's what the Book of Enoch says. So is that the reptilians fit into that same story, the same type of being that operates from behind the scenes? Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting.
It is very interesting. And I mean, that's the thing about it, is like it's, and I think what your book is doing, which I think, you know, once again, folks, please go and buy the book, because as you can see, just in our conversation, The Secret History of Reptilians, you're getting a larger history lesson here. You know, yeah. you're getting something that might actually help put some pieces in place for a lot of different things that you may have always wondered about, unless people took, which so be it if they did, took it all at face value. If they're like looking at scripture, like, you know, Bible scripture or anything like that, you know.
Yes.
Very interesting. Let's see here. Seeing here, when we were talking about Queen Elizabeth being a reptilian.
Yeah.
Emily says that she didn't die. She just returned home. So there is that.
Well, she's like Doctor Who, and she morphed into somebody else.
She regenerated, and she is actually now King Charles. That makes no sense, actually, when I say that out loud. That's embarrassing.
Well, you know, what is also interesting about all of that is that the Anunnaki, it says that the Anunnaki was the tribe of the Danu, or the Anu, and that they went from northern Mesopotamia and migrated east or west over to and ended up as the great European royal families are rooted in the Anunnaki, and the Anunnaki inextricably linked with the reptilian stories. And so this is where that all comes from, that Queen Elizabeth was from one of the royal families that was founded long time ago.
Right.
And so it's very interesting. Even the Irish, they have their story of the Tuatha De Danann, mm-hmm. or the Tuatha De Danu, the Anunnaki, is linked to the Tuatha, who are the tall, stately, elegant kings who came from the heavens, and came down to the earth, and were forced after the wars into the Hollow Hills and became known as the Elven folk. And so there's all this mythology that is all meshed together in all of this, and which makes it fascinating to start studying it.
It really does. Once again, go to Amazon, or do you prefer them to get the book somewhere else other than Amazon?
Well, you know, you can get it on Amazon, or you can go to probably one of the best places. You go to my website.
Mm-hmm.
It's just my full name, ScottAllenRoberts.com. And Alan is A-L-A-N. I always have to spell it out because there's 10 ways to spell Alan.
There really is. Do they get a signed copy if they get it through your site?
If I don't have any on hand. It all comes through my publisher.
Oh, sure.
So when I have some on hand, I have some of the Nephilim books on hand, and I've got a few of those. But if you order it, get a hold of me, and we'll make sure. I'm actually very local to you, as you mentioned.
You are.
I'm 45 minutes outside of the Twin Cities.
What area are you in? What area are you in?
I'm in Somerset.
Oh, you're
so
okay.
If you go to Old Stillwater Bridge, if you went across Stillwater into Wisconsin, we're 10 miles up from there.
And I'm out in St. Michael. So
okay, the opposite way.
Yeah, just the opposite way. And then this book, The Secret History of the Reptilians, The Pervasive Presence of Serpent in Human History, Religion, Alien Mythos, that was published in 2013. I'm wondering if I have you back on, do you want me to talk about a book that goes even further back, or you maybe sure. something actually?
Well,
the
one before that is The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim. That's probably my key topic when I talk about these things. I also wrote after Reptilians. I wrote with a friend of mine, John Ward, who is a British archaeologist in Egypt. We wrote the book called The Exodus Reality. And it's not a story of the Bible. It's a story of the historicity of a biblical character. Did Moses exist? Did the Exodus actually took place from the point of view of Egyptian history? So I spent a lot of time over in Egypt with John, and he's got his site there, Gebel El Silsila, their archaeological site. And we traveled all over the place.
That's great.
Writing that particular book. So
I'm going to have to cut you off because we're just about done here. Once again, ScottAllenRoberts.com. Go get the book. See what else Scotty Roberts has written. Scotty, thank you so much. This was fantastic.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
I hope to have you on again. I'd really like that.
Be fun.
All right, everyone. We'll see you tomorrow. Take care.